Big news! This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further, literally. They cover all things travel finance, like which flight deals are actually deals and which are clickbait. They'll also tell you when to skip the bundle and book separately. Plus, how to avoid paying for upgrades that you won't use. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Fromer. Today, we're going to be focusing on deep adventure travel. And I have the world's foremost expert here to talk to me about that. He is Scott Brady. I'm going to read a little bit of his bio. He is the CEO of Overland International, the parent company of Overland Journal Magazine, the Overland Journal podcast, and the website Expedition Portal. He, as an overlander, he's circumnavigated the planet 3 times and was the first overlander to cross all 7 continents. And the reason we have him on the show today is he has a wonderful new book out. It's called Overlanding 101, A Field Guide to Vehicle-Based Adventure Travel. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Fromer Travel Show.
Oh, thank you so much. It's such an honor to be on here with you.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that. And I think we have to start with the basics because I have a feeling a lot of our listeners probably have never heard the term overlanding. So what is overlanding?
Well, I'll start with the basic definition, which is vehicle-based adventure travel. And the reason why we include those different terms in the definition is we're typically going to be using an adventure motorcycle or maybe a Land Cruiser or even an old Mercedes sedan, something like that, some mechanized form of travel. And then we're going to be looking for adventure. So it's not just a road trip. It's not the classic car trip. It's going to actually be something with a little bit more adventure. We're going to be going and experiencing a new culture or a new place to us, or maybe a very remote destination. Sometimes it includes crossing continents. Sometimes it's just going to the next state over.
It's interesting. I was sitting at a bar last night. I was eating dinner at the bar, reading your book, and I was trying to explain it to the guy next to me who happened to look at it. And he kept saying, well, sounds like camping. Okay. Sounds like a road trip. Sounds like this. Sounds like that. Even with the explanation you just gave, how is this different than those sorts of travel?
Well, and I love that you ask that question because it's much like if you and I were going to go out on a walk, like around the neighborhood, we would call it a walk. If we were going to go out into the woods for an afternoon and go for a walk, we would probably call it a hike.
Right.
If we were to climb to the top of a mountain, we wouldn't be hiking, we would be mountaineering. And so I feel that, at least in language, you and I both love the written word. So sure. At least in language, definition is important. And a way to describe an activity is important. So car camping would maybe be something like a walk, whereas going on a road trip may be something like a hike. Whereas overlanding is the mountaineering version of that, where you're incorporating so many more skills. You're much more remote. You need to navigate. You need to have a way to be self-sufficient, deal with medical emergencies, communicate with assistance if you get into trouble. And you're much more self-reliant in either a more remote, more difficult, or more foreign location than you're familiar with.
Right. But it kind of started like taking a walk, because when cars were young, just taking a car a long distance was overlanding. And I love the fact that you start the book with the history of overlanding. And I'd love it if you tell our readers about Bertha Benz.
Oh, I love that you bring her up, because she is such an inspiration. She's not only the first person to have taken a road trip or an overland journey. I'm sure it would have felt very much like an overland journey to her. But she was also the business mind and the financier of Mercedes-Benz. Now, at the time, history didn't acknowledge her for the significant impact that she had, but we get to do that now.
Yeah.
We get to, in 2025, we get to acknowledge that Mercedes-Benz would not have existed without her. And that quite possibly just this idea of venturing off, grabbing a car and venturing off, maybe had taken a lot longer if it wasn't for her as well. So Bertha Benz is a total rock star when it comes to vehicle-based travel. So she deserves to be acknowledged in that first position in the book.
And she also took a long road trip, right? Which was unheard of in those days. So tell us what she did.
Yeah, it had never happened before. I don't remember specifically where she drove from and to in Germany, but it was about 130 miles, this was when cars weren't even known to the general public. They were so early in production. And the fact that she had the wherewithal, that was willing to take a risk and go drive 130 miles across Germany in the late 1800s is so amazing.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And you tell about her having her sons with her and people couldn't believe she had the courage to do this. Fast forward to today, you have gone to 7 continents, all with the same vehicle. So that must have been a lot of logistics. And as you say in the book, just planning for these adventures is part of the adventure, right?
It is. It is. And that's part of the joy of it. Just as in with your guidebooks, I like to refer to them to come up with new ideas of places to go, maybe even destinations that I hadn't even considered. And that's where I love a printed book. I love to be able to leaf through it and have the images delight me, much like a menu would in a restaurant. You're kind of looking for the thing that appeals to you that day. So for me, it really is about taking in all of the planning, all of the logistics, the challenges of that. How do I ship the car from South Africa to Antarctica, for example? How do we do those things? It's very complex, and I love the logistical challenges of that.
Yeah. And you give the top 10 overlanding routes at the back of the book.
Yes.
And some of these names, they just light up the adventurer in you. I mean, the first one you say, the Silk Road in Central Asia, 4,000 miles, 6,400 kilometers, takes 8 to 12 weeks, but interestingly, only a difficulty of 5 out of 10. Why is that an easier overlanding route?
The road conditions are better. So the majority of the Silk Road, as we know it today, can be traveled in a stock vehicle. Where it becomes more difficult, for example, was when I did a double crossing of the Antarctic continent, which required a highly specialized vehicle, and the travel conditions were much more severe. We averaged minus 40 degrees every day.
Wow.
So it was a very challenging climate and conditions for the vehicle. Whereas the Silk Road is a little bit more of like a cultural challenge. You're going from very different place to very different place. You're dealing with a lot of border crossings. So you want to make sure your documents are in good order and that you have a lot of patience when you get there.
But you make the point in the book that border crossings have now gotten easier because of e-documents, right? Now you can get an electronic visa rather than having to find the damn official building and wait and do all that stuff. Is overlanding an easier activity right now because of things like GPS and e-visas and other technological innovations?
No question. I would say that for me, the trips that I do are far easier than someone even 20 years ago, certainly 30 years ago, when GPS would have been very nascent, not even really available to most people. So navigation is easier now. Back then, I think of Tom Shepard, who I speak about in the book, that crossed the Sahara in the 1960s. They were using compass, sun compass, sextants to find their way across the Sahara because GPS did not exist. So it has gotten much easier. E-Visa makes it easier. You know, just credit cards are now much more ubiquitous and it's easier to do those transactions. I find that there's really good information out there too. There's a lot of active information on various forums and Facebook groups to know what the border conditions are.
Right. But there still are challenges. And one of the things I love about this book is not only is it fun to read, it's beautifully illustrated. And early on in the book, you go into different types of driving with different levels of danger and skills needed to do it. Sure. And it starts with a paved road. Anybody can do it. And it ends with a photo of a guy fording a river in a Jeep. And the guy next to me at the bar, he's like, wait, the engine would be underwater. That's impossible. Yeah. How do you do these things? So that was so fascinating to me. You also had a section about how to drive in deep mud and in snow. And since I thought this could be helpful for any type of driving, where, you know, you don't have to be overlanding for this, can you give some tips for deep mud and then for snow?
Well, one of the things that helps the most is having the right tires. So if you know you're going to be encountering snowy conditions, people that live in the Northeast, they oftentimes have winter tires, which are going to have a better compound. They're going to be designed to perform better in snow and ice on slippery conditions. So starting off with the right tires is really the best thing that you can do. And then after that, you want to, Land Rover has a great phrase that I like to use, which is as slow as possible, but as fast as necessary. So there are times in the mud that you need a little bit of momentum to get through a deeper section. So be mindful of not going so slow that your wheels start to spin and then your chassis gets grounded and then you've lost your momentum. So a little bit of momentum is very helpful in the snow and in the mud. Of course, on the ice, you want to be as mindful as possible of throttle inputs so that you don't slide.
Right. And it also, I mean, when you get very technical about it, it also has to do with how much air should be in your tires.
Correct.
and other assets. A fascinating book. I thought that made the book worth the money just to read that section. I mean, for any type of trip that you're doing.
Oh, you talk about tire pressure in Antarctica and Greenland. When I crossed the long axis of Greenland, the ice sheet, we were driving at 2 or 3 PSI in the tires. So that way we could float on top of the snow. Huh. So the tire pressure becomes so critical.
Yeah. You also give a kind of a chart for determining your travel pace. And I also thought this also would be so useful for people like on a developed world primary road, you can pretty much estimate that you're going to be going 60 miles an hour. But if you know you're, say, on a dirt 2-track trail, it's only going to be 15 miles an hour. And if it's a maintained dirt road, it's 25 miles per hour. I think thanks to Google Earth and different things that we can now easily find on our phones, you can see the type of road and you can then figure out how long it's going to take. And that's a huge part of the planning, right? What your pace is going to be for an overlanding journey.
I agree. And it removes a lot of anxiety for the traveler. Once they know what the road conditions are like, or they've talked to locals, or they've asked others that are maybe living in the area, you know, there's never underestimate the power of local knowledge. So if you can get some insights on the road conditions, then you can make sure that you've not been too ambitious in your schedule for the day. That way you don't get driving at night. One of the most dangerous things about travel in general, it doesn't just apply to overlanding, but you want to be very mindful of traveling at night. And that's not necessarily because there's bandidos out there. It's just that there could be animals on the road. There could be someone that's drunk that's driving on the road. It's much more difficult to navigate effectively. So we don't want to be driving at night if we can help it. So planning our day properly and getting our pacing right helps us make sure we get into the hotel or into camp before it's dark.
Right. And you do every once in a while stay in a hotel when you're overlanding. It's not all roughing it, right?
That's correct. In fact, there are many countries where you're better off staying in a local hostel or in a small pension or in a little hotel. And that's where guidebooks like yours are so helpful because you can find the ones that are highly recommended. But I like to plan for hotels probably every 2 or 3 nights because that way, you know, you can get a good shower. You can, you know, recharge yourself and maybe the batteries of your camera and a bunch of other things. And it also allows you to interact with the culture. So the reason why I don't want to be remote every night is that I want to experience the people in these places that I'm visiting. And one of the best ways to do that is find a classic old hotel right in the downtown square of whatever city or village you're visiting.
Right, right. Now, the book isn't all advice. Every once in a while, you tell us about one of your adventures, which brings it all to life, like the time you saved a prince. Can you tell our listeners that story? I thought that was amazing.
Well, thank you. It was completely by chance. It was when I was crossing Antarctica with a group called Expedition 7. A good friend of mine, Greg Miller, and I had decided to take the same vehicle to all 7 continents. And one of the ones that we needed to take it to was Antarctica. And we were on our way to the South Pole, and the sat phone rang, which it hadn't rang the whole time we were driving across.
Satellite phone.
Yes, yeah. The satellite phone. Thank you. The satellite phone rang, which it hadn't done the whole trip. So it was a bit of a shock when it came ringing through. And it was a gentleman by the name of Emil from Iceland who said, "Hey, I'm here with Prince Harry, and we're in a bit of trouble. We aren't going to make it to the South Pole in time to catch the plane, the last flight that was leaving the South Pole." They were actually 100 kilometers behind schedule.
Wow. Now,
to these gentlemen's credit, they were actually helping wounded veterans have this incredible experience of skiing to the South Pole. So some of them were amputees, some of them were blinded. So the pace was slower than they expected. We come back to that pace concept again. So the pace was slower than expected, and they weren't going to make it. So they, you know, Prince Harry said, "Hey, can you come give us a hand?" So it's not every day that you get to save a prince. So we drove about 14 kilometers out of our way, and we loaded all their gear in the trucks, and we loaded all the people up, and we drove them 100 kilometers closer to the pole so that they could finish their objective.
Pretty amazing. Was Prince Harry a nice guy?
He really was. He deserves a lot of credit. When we got there, of course, he was very, you know, charming and as a prince would be, and very personable and very grateful for our assistance. But then he jumped right up on top of the truck and people started throwing him gear, and he was working along with everyone else, like everyone else. And I really had the impression that he liked being remote like that with other people that respected him as a traveler, as an adventurer, and didn't treat him like a prince. I think he liked being in the rough and tumble that day.
Huh, interesting. And this brings up another topic in the book. These are adventures, obviously, but you can also do good while you're doing these adventures. A lot of overlanders work with organizations to help deliver needed goods, or to a volunteer in some other ways. Can you talk a little bit about the ways you can make these overlanding journeys more meaningful?
Well, thank you so much for asking that question, because as travelers, all of us, if it's someone who likes to travel by aircraft or they only have 2 weeks for a vacation, there's always a way to give back to these communities and cultures that we get to experience. There's ways to help preserve those cultures so we minimize our influence or our impact on those cultures when we're visiting. A great example of that is when you're driving through a country, if you come into a small village and you wanted to give the children of the village something, never give it to them from the vehicle, because that encourages them to run out to the road. Huh. So you never want children running out to the road to try to get something. Talk to the local headmaster at the school. Find out what they need. They may not need pencils. What they may need is food for breakfast. So reach out to those schools ahead of time. Ask them what they really need. And then drive up to the facility. Work with the headmaster. So that way you're not encouraging those children to run out to the road. And make sure that we're also giving the school something that they really need. That's a way that any traveler can help. And then people also love the idea of being a part of an expedition And one of the ways that you can change an overland journey into an expedition is through philanthropic work. So we can help a scientist access a remote region to do some sampling of the soil. We can work with doctors to bring medical supplies to remote villages so they can have procedures done that they would never otherwise have access to. There are ways that we can help transport these scientists, physicians, even aid workers into these remote regions so that we can do good while we're traveling.
And how do you find that scientist who needs to be going somewhere, or the aid organization? What are the resources you use to turn your trip into, as you said, an expedition?
Yeah, I love that because I do it a couple different ways. I have a lot of folks in my life that are into this kind of thing, and I always reach out before I'm going on a trip to find a way to give back. But there's also organizations that support that. So one of the ones that I like to use is the Royal Geographical Society out of London. You can reach out to them and find out what expeditions they have coming up or what needs they have that overlanders can participate in. And then there's also the Explorers Club out of New York. And I'm a fellow of the Explorers Club. So there are ways that I can reach out to the various members of the Explorers Club and find out where I can give back as an overland traveler.
Okay, so getting back to the adventure itself, you talk, and here's another part of the book that I thought would be helpful for people on any type of adventure. You talk about in a section called The Company We Keep, choosing the right people to travel with, and I'm going to read a little bit of it. You're talking about your travel companions on a certain trip, Brian McVickers, Dave Harrington, and Chris Wood, and you say they're all level-headed, respectful, and game for nearly any challenge. Some are better at planning, some are better at execution, but all are as dependable as the day is long. Frustrations will invariably arise on any trip, so the company we keep will make all the difference when things go sideways. I remember the night when the sand blew so hard that our stake tents buckled and our sleeping bags filled with silica. There was not a single grumble from the group, and the hardship was addressed with self-deprecating humor and optimisms. Egos had been checked at the border, and we all worked to make the trip a success for everyone. So how the hell do you find people like that who are going to check their egos? Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things I always say about group travel, group tours, that there's always somebody on that tour you wish you weren't traveling with.
Oh, wow. That's so true. That's
so
true.
So how do you make sure that your traveling companions are going to enhance rather than destroy the trip?
There's a couple ways that we can do that. The best way is to take a small trip with them, or even go out to dinner, see how they interact with the server, see how they show deference to the other people at the table, asking them questions, participating in the storytelling as an equal partner in the conversation. There's really ways to study human behavior that give us some insights on how they're going to behave during a longer trip. But most often we actually travel with people that we already know. So for example, you may travel with a best friend, or you may travel with a husband or a wife. So the best thing that we can do, usually there's the one person who really wants to travel and the other one's kind of along for the journey. The best thing that we can do is to sit down and have a conversation with our partner about what they want to experience on the trip. Because otherwise they're just being tagged along. Maybe you'll find out that they really have a love for history. Maybe you'll find out that they really don't want to sit in the car for more than 4 or 5 hours a day. Or maybe you may find that they want to get out and move and walk every day, and that helps them feel better. Or maybe they have some dietary needs that help them feel less anxious about visiting a place if they know that they can find the food that they need. So sitting down and have a conversation with our travel companions is the most effective way to eliminate those misunderstandings further down the road, or those tensions that may arise. If someone gets to have their self heard and their anxieties or their needs seen, and we make sure that we incorporate it into the plan, we're much better at having a good outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know, at one point in the book, you say, it's not an adventure if something doesn't go wrong.
I don't know that that's the best definition. It is my definition for sure.
But that's where the stories come from.
I agree.
Those are the travels you remember when things really go sideways. Like when I was traveling with my daughter who was on crutches, so we rented a wheelchair for her. We were self-driving a boat. The locks were going to close unexpectedly. And so we had to drive when we didn't think we were going to. And the wheelchair rolled off the boat and into the canal. And it was gone. But that's a story that I'll always remember, even though at the time it was horrible. It was horrible. But anyway. But
that's such a great story. And it's a reminder. It's a reminder that we can't control.
You just can't.
When we're traveling, we're technically out of control. Right. Because we're not in our home.
Yeah.
We're not in a familiar place. So we can't control everything. So just like you did, laugh it off a little bit and realize you can find another wheelchair.
We couldn't, but
that makes the story even more interesting. For sure.
But you're right about laughing it off. And so you want to have travel companions who can laugh these things off. And luckily for that trip, I was traveling with my daughter's boyfriend who I hadn't known that well. In advance, now I'm a huge fan of his because he just rolls with the punches. He's always looking for where the fixes are. I really adore him. He's a great guy.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. One of the things that really surprised me in the book was you write at one point, because you discuss a lot of crazy adventures where you're foot almost slips into a crevice on the ice sheet of Greenland and other hair-raising things that seem to be putting your life in danger every other moment. And yet you say at one point that people who take these types of adventures tend to live longer than the folks who are homebodies, the people who never leave their backyard. And I was wondering, where did you get that from? And I love that idea.
Yeah, I do have a source, and I'll need to get that to you. There's actually a few interesting sources around that. But if we just think about it from the perspective of the more that we travel, the more we become self-aware, the more we're aware of our surroundings, the more different scenarios we've had to drive in, maybe even on the other side of the road. So the more that we expose ourselves to these things that make us a better driver, make us a more aware traveler, even make us a little more fit. Because we've walked a lot and we've interacted with other people, we're a little less stressed because we can handle the punches of life. Whereas the person that takes the same drive every day and they work in the same office, they aren't exposing themselves to the things that make us stronger. When we go to the gym and we lift weights, we're a little sore the next day, but we become stronger. And it's the same thing as travelers. The more that we're effective at research, the more that we're a better driver, or the more fit we are, the more we're able to handle awkward situations or identify danger, the less likely we are to be a victim of that in our day-to-day life.
Yeah, I love that. And I love the book. So many, many congratulations. I think
you're going to create
a whole new generation of overlanders with this book and with your other work.
Oh, thank you, Pauline. And a big thanks to you and your family for creating these Frommer's Guides. They are books that I have used in my own travels. I love the tenor of these books and how they inspire people to get out and see the world.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. And that is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
You Luxury flights and hotels can be had for free. The world of points and miles sounds too good to be true, but it's actually real, but only if you know what you're doing.
On Frequent Miler on the Air, Greg and I'm Nick, discuss all the ways to earn points and miles and use them for outsized value.
Join us every Friday for our full episodes and every Tuesday for our quick, single-topic coffee break episodes.
See you there.